I gave you this book to read, and I expect you to read it. Revolution and Renewal, How Churches Are Saving the Cities. The first 50 pages. If you don't read the first 50 pages, you're going to miss something wonderful. These are some of the most touching and wonderful stories of inner city ministry that you're ever going to read. And I love that, because before I get into anything about how to structure this and how to structure that, you've got to get the feel of what inner city kids are having to endure, what they have to live with day in and day out. That's there in the book. Do you have any questions about any of these ministries and what we're doing and how we're doing it and how to raise money and how to sustain them and how to put together a board of directors, which is simply this, that you ask people who you know and like. I always found that more important than getting rich people. It's nice if they're rich. Try, if you can, to get somebody who has accounting skills on your board. Try to get a lawyer on your board. We're overstacked with lawyers. We had two lawyers and one judge. We don't mess around. But you want them to be varied in background. Insofar as it is possible, you want diversity. You want people of different races and not just a bunch of men. Unfortunately, our board is not very diverse, but we're working on it. Any questions? Yes, sit.
How does something like what you've described work if there isn't Tony Campolo, the dynamic, charismatic, energetic personality?
I don't know. I think that almost every program needs a high-profile person because people identify with the high-profile person. What I suggest you do is this, and I've seen it done, is somebody's doing preaching, and you see he is a charismatic personality. A good example is this young man, Shane Claiborne, who now has become an international figure as a speaker, and he's not out of his 20s yet, wrote this book, The Irresistible Revolution. He is totally sacrificial. I mean, he is a Franciscan to the nth degree. He and some of his friends have moved into the Kensington area of Philadelphia and call themselves The Simple Way. Read about them in the book, The Irresistible Revolution. He's got charisma, and he is able to electrify young people. And so we've said, Shane, I know what you don't want to do. You don't want to set up an office, because the last thing you want to do is to get into organizational work. But you have to answer letters. Somebody has to arrange your speaking itinerary. Somebody's got to do the secretarial work. Here's the trade-off. Will you become the spokesperson for Mission Year? Everywhere you go, you're going to meet young people who want to do urban work like you. Say, look, I can't take you in, but if you really want to do urban work, I want you to come and join our organization called Mission Year. So we tap somebody, and on a trade-off, we'll do this for you, you do this for us. Remember, reciprocity is the name of the game. You know, if whenever somebody says, I want to help you, fine. What do you want in return? There's got to be always this reciprocity, because then you can rely on the person. But I think you need to look for the charismatic leader. Please understand that this is pure sociology. Max Weber, once again, one of the top five founders of modern sociology, wrote a book called Social and Economic Organization. It's a key textbook. Anybody in sociology has to study Max Weber's Social and Economic Organization. Got the picture? But in it, he points out that movements start with a charismatic leader. It's as simple as that. A charismatic leader. A charismatic leader is able, here's the measure of a charismatic leader, whether he's able to envision the future of what can be done in such a way that the people see that this is perfectly workable. I'll tell you who's a charismatic leader in business, and that's Donald Trump. He was completely bankrupt at one point, And they said, that's the end of Donald Trump. Well, it is not the end of Donald Trump. He began to rebuild his whole movement. But what he did was he would go and say, I have this wonderful program going. And I love this interview that he had with him. And he said, by wonderful program, I'm going to build this huge facility in downtown Philadelphia. It's going to be 40 stories high, and it's going to have these kind. And we're already on our way. Already on the way, he said on this interview, we had dug a hole in the ground. That's all we had. But he was able to describe the whole thing and how it was going to operate and why it was going to success with such effectiveness. The people say, this is workable. This is a great deal. I want to put my money in this, do you see? Namely, a charismatic personality is able to electrify people into believing in the future, believing that what he or she has envisioned can happen. Make it sound so real that the person can visualize it, can actually see it working. That's crucial to the charismatic leader. Weber began to analyze this whole process of how an organization gets started. He really used religious organizations as his model. I mentioned that line by Mark Hatfield. Started in Jerusalem, ends up as a business enterprise. This process is called in sociology, it actually has a name. It's called, here it is, the increasing tendency to rationalization. You have to have an understanding of that term. The increasing tendency to rationalization. Movements start with charisma, but over a period of time, rational forces come into play, and we move from being a movement to a bureaucracy. It's inevitable. Nowhere did he see this more evident than in Christianity, and he wasn't a Christian. But Jesus starts this movement. No organization. He has no fundraising system. He's got nothing. He's just got charisma. He comes with a vision. He comes with a spirit. He comes from God. Ah, that's a good thing to look for in a charismatic leader. Charismatic leader always seems to project that he has power from beyond himself. Incidentally, a charismatic leader doesn't have to be a good person. Hitler was a charismatic personality. He was able to electrify the battered, beaten people of Germany. And he made them believe that he could make Germany great again. And he did it so convincingly that people flocked to him. Eric Fromm, in his classic, a little sociological book called Escape from Freedom, makes it clear. So often we get this idea that Hitler took over Germany and through the sheer force of military power imposed his will on the German people so that they capitulated against their will. Baloney. What Fromm points out is these people flocked to Hitler. They loved Hitler. Hitler, with the sheer dynamism of his speaking ability, was able to draw people to him. They loved Hitler. They laid down their lives for Hitler. They believed in Hitler. He, in fact, did not impose himself on anybody. They chose, here it is, they chose to give up their individual freedom in order to buy into the vision of Germany that Hitler made so clear to them and made them believe in. He could make Germany great again. He could make Germany great again. Brilliant. Brilliant. Evil. So a charismatic leader doesn't have to be godly. I'm talking about godly charismatic leaders. But Hitler pointed out that somehow he was the conveyor of the great German Geist. Did you ever hear that German word? The Geist. The spirit of Germany. That somehow the spirit of Germany was flowing through him. And he would raise his fist. If you've ever seen him, he looks more wild than the wildest evangelist you've ever seen preaching. Screaming to that great Nuremberg rally with hundreds of thousand people yelling, Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! And he's up there screaming and yelling and making them believe that they are the greatest force on the face of the earth and that nothing can stop Germany. Whoa! Charismatic leader. There are godly charismatic leaders. Jesus was a charismatic leader. No question about it. Jesus was a charismatic leader. And Christianity starts as a movement. No organization, no structure, no synod or presbytery making decisions. Just a bunch of people infused with the Spirit of Christ. And this thing begins to grow and grow and grow. But here's the point. Weber points out, and especially his disciple, Ernst Troeltsch. You can look up his spelling later. Ernst Troeltsch was his disciple and student. Said over a period of time, the thing kept on growing and growing and growing. And when a movement grows to a certain point, you have to organize it. That's the beginning of the end. You have to organize it. You have to, in fact, put certain people in charge of what's going on in this part of the country and certain people in charge of what's going on in that part of the country. You got to organize the thing. You got to organize who's in and who's out, who are members and who aren't. And you put up regulations for membership. And it keeps on growing and growing and growing. And all of a sudden, it's this massive thing. And it's organized. Now, the charismatic leader dies. We all do. You will. I will. We all will. We will all die. The charismatic leader dies. What happens? Do you find another charismatic leader? No. Because that's exactly what you don't want now. The charismatic leader does not know how to do organizational work. He doesn't care about organization, or she doesn't care about organization. Joan of Arc is a charismatic. Doesn't care about organization. But now the thing has grown. And you want to get a successor to the charismatic founder. What do you look for? You look for somebody who has bureaucratic skills. You look for somebody who is a bureaucrat and knows how to what? Run an organization. Is this a different kind of personality? Indeed. If you were to look at the great denominations of the world, the Presbyterian Church, USA, the American Baptist, the Episcopal Church, the people who are at the top, who are the spokespersons for the group, are not charismatic people. That's not their job. Their job is to maintain an organization. The Archbishop of Canterbury right now has got a problem because the whole Anglican Church is on the verge of splitting up over the homosexual issue. And the guy is working overtime, trying to hold this organization together. And what do you need in order to do that? Incredible bureaucratic skills. Incidentally, the big churches in America, for the most part, are not being led by seminary graduates. Hate to break it to you. Joel Osteen is not a seminary graduate. Bill Hybels of the great Willow Creek Church is not a seminary graduate. You say, didn't he go to college? Of course he went to college. Did he go to graduate school? Of course he went to graduate school. He has an MBA degree. Whoa. You mean the guy who's the pastor of the biggest, most effective church in America didn't go to seminary? He went to business school? Exactly. This thing has grown so large that now what you need is a bureaucratic guy. I mean, a charismatic leader can only lead the movement so far. At a particular point, it has to be taken over by somebody who is a bureaucrat. So every movement tends to become a bureaucracy. Any of you Methodists here? Do we have a Methodist in this group? Well, that's a shame, because I'm into the Methodist. Started by John Wesley. It was a movement within the Anglican Church of England. He never planned to start a new denomination. As a matter of fact, he remained a priest in the Anglican Church till the day he died. It was a movement within the Anglican Church. And it grew and grew and grew and grew. And it had to be organized. John Wesley, in addition to having charismatic gifts, being able to electrify audiences, also had good bureaucratic skills. And he began to organize. He got all these young men to become preachers, circuit riders on horseback. They had never been to school. He constructed what he called the Christian Library. Every guy who got to be one of these circuit riders got a set of books. Read these. This will keep you going. This will satisfy your needs. Everything you need to know to be an effective preacher, you'll find in these books. Gave them a course of study, set them up bureaucratically, got the thing going. It kept on growing and growing and growing and growing. It grew like wildfire. It was a movement. Let me say this. The relationship between evangelism and social change, evident in John Wesley. Henry Steele Cominger, who wrote the great book, The American Mind, perhaps the best historian of our time in the United States, operating out of Amherst College in Massachusetts, has this statement. The effects of the Wesleyan movement were so far-reaching that they kept England from having to go through the likes of a French Revolution. There were all kinds of injustices. There were all kinds of horrible things happening in Paris. Children were being oppressed. Degradation was everywhere at hand. Poverty pervaded the land. So what happened? The peasants rose up and violently overthrew the government, chopped off the heads of all the aristocrats, sent the church packing, took over all the church property. Those of you who have been to Paris, and I saw a few of you, there is a building on the West Bank, which was the last big church built in Paris, called the Parthenon. It was just being completed at the end of the French Revolution. It never became a church. Instead, they put on the high altar a big question mark to exemplify the religion of reason. We should be asking questions. If you go there, all the atheistic philosophers of Paris are buried there. You know, Rousseau is one, for instance. You can go down the list. All the great French atheists are buried there. The church was destroyed. Never has recovered in France. Didn't happen in England. Because they didn't need a violent revolution to overthrow the evils of the world. What you needed was a spiritual revival. You people who come from Church of the Brethren, from the Mennonite tradition, that's the great theme. We don't have to use violence to bring about social change. That in fact, social change can begin with people being inwardly transformed and challenging the rest of the society to respond. One of the wonderful stories I know about Church of the Brethren is a young man from Church of the Brethren went to work with Clarence Jordan in Koinonia Farms down in Americus, Georgia. I'll tell you about Americus at another time. But it was during the Vietnam War, and this young man did not want to go into the military because he was nonviolent, nor did he want to register as a conscientious objector because he felt that if he registered as a conscientious objector, they wouldn't make him into a combatant, but they would send him overseas to be in the support system of the army, which will only release somebody else to do the killing. So he didn't want to go in the army out of sheer conviction. The day for him to appear in court came. Clarence went with him. Evidently, this young man explained why his conscience was driving him to do what he did, to be what he was, to take the stand that he was taking. He was so eloquent and so persuasive that Clarence said, I could actually see the eyes of the judge showing signs of tearing. And at the end of the presentation, the judge said, young man, you have moved me. I want to just dismiss this case. But I am left with no alternative. And the young man said, I have something to say. And Clarence is trying to quiet the kid down because obviously he's going to get a very light sentence if he just doesn't mess it up. And the judge starts again. What I'm trying to tell you, sir, is that as the judge of this court, I have no alternative, but I have something to say, he yelled. And the third time it happened, please, let me finish. I'm telling you that as an upholder of the law of the state of Virginia, I have no option. I have something to say, the young man shouted. And then he said, you tell me that you have no choice? As the judge of this court, you have no choice? You do have a choice. You can resign. Is that powerful? You can resign. You do have a choice. Don't tell me that you're forced into this. That's the charismatic speaker who suddenly makes you see that you're doing certain things and you act like you have to. You have no choice. You always have a choice. That's the way social change begins. People begin to hear that story and begin to go across and say, that's right, there is a choice out there. And people begin to think differently. The kingdom of God is within you. And so you don't need violence to do it. The Wesleyan revivals are evidence of that. Incidentally, you should know this, another name that has to be on your calendar. It's Charles Finney. Got that? Charles Finney. Charles Finney led the great revivals in the middle of the 1800s. A name you also have to know, and you'll hear often in this course, is Jim Wallace, who not only wrote the book God's Politics, but now has written another book that is just out this month called The Great Awakening. Because there was a Great Awakening that gave birth to the country, there was a second Great Awakening that occurred in the middle of the 1800s. And both of these Great Awakenings had far-reaching social consequences. The first one basically gave birth to this country. Every historian will tell you that prior to 1776, the United States was not a set of United States. They were 13 distinct colonies, each of which saw itself as a nation in and of itself. But the great Wesleyan revivals came to America under the influence of George Whitefield and swept from one end of the country to the other, all up and down the seacoast. The result is the spiritual oneness that was generated through the Wesleyan revivals carried here by George Whitefield, unified the country. And for the first time, under the power of the Holy Spirit, the nations of the United States saw themselves as one people. The Spirit of God can do that, you know. The second Great Awakening is in the middle of the 1800s, under the influence of Charles Finney. The Finney Revival swept primarily across what we call the northern tier of New York, starting in New York City, going up the Hudson, and then across the area became the burnt over region. I don't know why, probably because there were a lot of forest fires there or something, but every historian will tell you about the burnt over region where religious revival went like wildfire. He's the guy that invented the invitation, you know. We Baptists are big on it. You've been in Baptist churches where we do an invitation at the end of every service, 20 verses of just as I am, and people come down just as they are and go out just as they were. You know, that's our thing. He is the guy that invented the invitation. But here's the interesting thing. When you came down the aisle to become a Christian, he took you into the back room, and you didn't get a Gospel of John and a little prayer. There were two tables, one for the suffrage movement, i.e. the feminist movement. And the other table was the anti-slave movement. And if you came down the aisle to become a Christian, you had to, in fact, sign up for one or the other of these two movements. The idea being what? God is at work in the world. He's changing the world socially, politically, economically. He's changing the world. And this needs to be said. The God that is at work in the world is inviting you to join him. So becoming a Christian isn't just believing in Jesus so you can go to heaven when you die. This is very important for this whole course. Becoming a Christian is discerning where God is at work in the world and joining God in the work of God in this world. It's joining the work of God in this world. And he was saying, right now, what I see is God is at work through the anti-slave movement and through the feminist movement. Now, if you go back to the hymns of the era, you will pick this up. The most famous of the hymns, of course, is the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Which is what? Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. No, the second coming isn't Jesus coming out of the clouds. It's what? I have seen God at work in the world. I have seen him in the campfires of 100 circling camps. I have seen him at work in the world. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth is marching on. That Battle Hymn of the Republic basically said, I see God at work in the world, and we are called to join with him and to participate with him, if you want to use him for God, to do the work of God in the world. So you had to join up. So you can see the connection between real spiritual revival and social justice. As a matter of fact, you should know this, that Charles Finney has a set of books that you should know about. It's called his Notes on Revival. And the point is that revival can never take place unless the people of God commit themselves to social justice. And he explains why from the scriptures. Note that verse that I gave you the other day from 2 Chronicles. If my people who are called by my name will what? Humble themselves and turn from their evil ways. If there will be a real revival in the world, I will restore the land. What we all want in America these days, and I hear all these groups praying for revival. Promise Keepers, who I think is one of the great things that's going on in America today, but it's beginning to lose its momentum. But Promise Keepers wanted to see a revival. There's this other thing called Women of Faith. Wonderful, gathering thousands of women together. But they often think that revival is simply going to be brought about by people getting this spiritual thing. No, a revival does not take place, says Finney in his brilliant analysis from Scripture, unless there is a commitment to social justice. God does not move into the land until people work for justice. Why? Because this is what the Scripture says. This is what we want from you, God. This is what we want. We want a revival in the land. And he answers, what do I require of you? I'll tell you what I require of you. Love justice. Do mercy. Walk humbly with your brother and your sister and your neighbor. Isn't that what it says? As a matter of fact, in the book of Isaiah, read the book of Isaiah. Finney picks this up. I am tired of your revival meetings. I am tired of your singing, all the praise music, you know. If I get to heaven and they have an overhead projector, I'm checking out. I got to tell you that, you know. But I am tired of all of this stuff. Here's what he says. It says this in the book of Isaiah. Your music is like cymbals in my ears. I deplore your solemn assemblies. Well, these all-night prayer meetings. I deplore your... When are you going to feed the hungry? When are you going to clothe the naked? When are you going to do justice in the world? You're waiting for revival? Revival's not going to happen until you commit yourself to social justice. Finney understood that. What we want in America today is revival without social justice. The Promise Keepers have begun to see this, but only begun. And so they're talking a great deal these days and putting a great emphasis on racial reconciliation. But I want to tell you something. You can't have racial reconciliation without economic justice. Because the reality is that what oppresses people is, in fact, this kind of thing, economic injustice. If you look at the race problem, you'll find economic factors right there. Nobody minds having an African-American family move in next door. As long as the guy is the vice president of Pepsi-Cola and earning $500,000 a year. What we don't want next door is that guy from North Philadelphia. Economics, it's crucial. Please understand this. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, but he was not there because he wanted to conduct a civil rights demonstration. You know that, don't you? You say, oh, he died marching for civil rights. No, he didn't. He went to Memphis because the garbage collectors were on strike. And most of the garbage collectors in Memphis were African-American guys, and they didn't have enough money to live. And he had come to join forces with them so that they could get more money for their labor. Why? Because he realized something. That the civil rights bill had been passed. And now, all over America, in Birmingham, Alabama, in Atlanta, black people could stay overnight in the Hyatt Hotel. They could stay overnight in the Marriott. Black people had these doors open to them. They had one problem. They couldn't afford to stay at the Marriott. They couldn't afford to stay at the Hyatt. Note, without economic freedom, there is no freedom. The poor are not free. The poor are not free. Please grasp that. You say, we've got a judicial system that treats everybody alike. It doesn't. It treats rich people different than the poor people. You say, you can go anywhere you want in America. Right now, for instance, they've taken down the racial barriers in Disneyland. As a matter of fact, Martin Luther King worked hard to bring down the racial barriers, keeping black people out of Disneyland. Go to Disneyland. You'll see a black family here or a black family there, but it is overwhelmingly the white middle class that shows up because it costs like $100 to get in there for the day. Can't afford it. You got a family of five, $500. Where are you going to get the money? Do you see what we're dealing with here? Are you really free to go to Disneyland if you're poor? Are you really free to stay at the Hyatt if you're poor? Are you really free to get social justice if you're poor? Let me ask you this. Is it possible to run for Congress if you're poor? So when you talk about freedom, but there's no economic justice, you're not talking about freedom at all. That's why in trying to transform the cities, we talk a great deal here at Eastern about economic development, justice for poor people, giving poor people the opportunity to solve their economic problems, empowering them, not being paternalistic, empowering them. I mean, if you go into economic development, I hope you don't start businesses that you own. The truth is, you have to start businesses that the people themselves own. There's one little story I've got to tell you. I had a wild experience one day. I spoke at the Philadelphia Rotary Club, and I simultaneously spoke that day, that evening, at a group of students at the University of Pennsylvania. The Rotary Club was slightly to the right of Hitler. The students were slightly to the left of Mao. Got the picture? You couldn't have come up with two more diverse groups. And in both groups, I was asked to explain microeconomic development in the third world. And I came and I did my pitch. At the end of the Rotary Club, I got a standing ovation. The Rotarians, with their laissez-faire right-wing politics, loved it. Patted me on the back and said, "You're the answer. Eastern's the answer. You're proving that the free enterprise system is the only escape from poverty. Not government programs." Does this sound very conservative? Not government programs, but grassroots work where you start businesses with free enterprise, with the government staying out of it. The free enterprise system. That's the answer to the problems of this world. That evening, I'm over with all these students over at the University of Pennsylvania, sociology students. And when I finish, they give me a standing ovation. And their response is, "This is great. This is great. What you have done is prove conclusively that Karl Marx had the answer to the economic problems of our world." I blinked. I said, "How do you figure that?" "Well, in Marx, the only time you have freedom is when the workers own the means of production. I hope you know enough about Marx to know how Marxism works. If not, we'll have to take a little time to do that. But the workers own the means of production, not the capitalists." See, capitalism is you got some people up here who never produce anything. They just buy stock. And the people down here do all the work, but they do not get the profits from their production. What Marx wanted to do was make the proletariat, the people, the owners of the factories. It's not the capitalists, it's the workers that will own. Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. When I taught at Penn, I used to teach all of these students who were going into business the union songs. You don't know union songs, but I know union songs. And you don't know them, and they're wonderful songs in the union movement, because the union movement started as a movement. It is now a bureaucratic organization. When they sit down to negotiate and you see the table, you can't tell the difference between management, and they're all dressed in the same blue suits. They're all wearing red ties. They all look alike and they all talk alike, and they talk in bureaucratic terms. The labor movement is no longer a movement. When my father was in the movement, it was a movement. They had rallies, they sang songs, they had hymns, real hymns. And what they did was they took church hymns and gave them new words, just like the civil rights movement did. Try this one. "Are you afraid when your hair's turning gray? They'll show you the gate and turn you away. Then join with the union and demand fair play. The union makes us strong. all together, we are stronger every way. AFL-CIO, we will work together, build together for a better day. AFL and CIO, together we'll work and together we'll stand and together we'll make this a happier land. So join with your brothers and walk hand in hand. The union makes us strong. Do you recognize the tune? You would know the tune, Marie. These young people wouldn't. You know the song.
There's power in
that's right. It's the old hymn. Would you be free from your burden of sin? There's power in the blood. Power in the blood. Would you or evil a victory win? They just took the hymn and gave it union words. They took the old battle hymn of the Republic, an old hymn. And it became solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. The union makes us strong. Listen to the Marxist tone of this song. They have taken millions from us that they never toiled to earn. Yet without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel would turn. Let's break their haughty power. And together let us learn. The union makes us strong. Get about 1,000 guys in the union hall standing up and singing together. Solidarity forever. You don't have the kind of union meetings we have today where these guys sit around saying, how do we get more money? And the, you know, when the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. But there is no power greater than, weaker than the weaker force of one. It goes on like this. Together, unity, union movements. These were highly Marxist movements, you see. But what they wanted to see is that the industries would change, and what would happen would be that the workers became the owners of the means of production. I was out to dinner with a guy who heard me lecture some years ago who had a big company, and he took out of the workers' salary every month, 10%, and put it in a private fund. And when he retired, he made all the workers into owners of the company. And the company, he says, is running brilliantly, you see. This was his gift to them. They had made him rich. He owed them something in return. This is good stuff. This is good stuff. People forget this. There was a wonderful story of a factory up in Boston, Massachusetts area, run by a Jewish man. It was a textile factory. The thing burned down. Do you remember hearing about this? It was became national, international news. And the owner of this factory, who had become a multimillionaire, told the workers, don't worry, we're going to rebuild the factory. In the meantime, I'm going to pay you full salary with benefits over the next 2 years. If you can go out and get another job and make money in the meantime, more power to you. I want you to know your job's waiting for you when we've got the place rebuilt. And the press asked him, how can you afford to do this? And he said, how can I afford not to do this? These are the people that made me rich. Do I not owe them this? Do you see? Marxism. The point is that microeconomic development, as we're describing it here, is both free enterprise and, in fact, semi-Marxist, in that the workers own the means of production. They own their own businesses, and this is the way to create social uplift. It can be done in the city. It can be done under your jurisdiction and inspiration.